Just who's running this clam bake anyway?
Phil's Osophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Stop doing it.
Phil, have you got any
I want it clear who's to blame here.
Until one of us actually refutes the other.
Are you kidding me?
This is Too Wretched for Radio. Little squabble. In Christian love, of course. I, Phil, wanted to do something else, but no. What does Phil want? Couldn't we just do the mailbag? Well, we could just do the mailbag, but I've got other stuff that's been presented. So you know what we're going to do, Phil?
Whatever you want.
We're going to do the mailbag.
All right.
Send yours to phil@wretched.org, phil@wretched.org, because I'm a giver, Phil. I do not insist on having my own way.
I love that about you.
Yep, so here we go. The story from Chris Volatin. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. That's the wrong stack right there. Still tempted. Send it to phil@wretched.org. Would you please speak about the involvement of the Puritans in the Salem witch trial? And do you have any books you'd recommend to study this?
Ooh.
That's from Suzanne in Frederick, Oklahoma.
Frederick. You know, I know Frederick, Oklahoma. I have a relative who comes from there. Oklahoma.
Is her name Suzanne?
No, I don't think so. But also,
he probably knows him because I'm thinking Frederick is not that big salute.
Also, the Salem witch trials, one of my favorite, I hesitate to say it that way because it sounds wrong, but it's one of my favorite episodes in American church history, or one of the ones I've studied the most, because it does pose some difficulties. I mean, these were Puritan pastors, godly men, and elders of churches and so on that participated in these trials that ended in the death of, I forget the exact number, it was about 19 people who were condemned and most of them hanged. No one was burnt in New England. They hanged most of them. One man was pressed to death, meaning that they put a board on top of him and just loaded it with rocks until he died from the sheer weight of it. Cruel, cruel thing. And, you know, it began to bother the consciences of the people because this was a church-based scandal. All these people were in the church, part of the church, and began to bother their consciences, and they began to raise questions because the witchcraft hysteria had started, some would say because of Cotton Mather's preaching on the devil and the reality of the unseen world. And there's partly truth in that. But also there were some young girls who began to manifest some strange, almost demonic phenomena and make accusations against people in the community. And these accusations were actually tried in courts and people condemned as witches and put to death. When it was all over, the judge who sort of oversaw the trials, his name was Samuel Sewell. He repented of that, and they called a day of fasting and repentance. And I think everyone was ashamed of that whole episode before that generation died off. So it was a temporary sort of hysteria that I don't think it discredits Puritanism, but it certainly is a black eye on the American style of Puritanism. What most people don't realize is that the reason it was stopped was because Increase Mather, he was Cotton Mather's father and also a respectable pastor in his own right, who I think was in England at the beginning of the witch trials. He returned to Massachusetts and immediately began to ask the hard questions about what was going on, and they put a stop to it, but not before several people had been condemned as witches and killed. So it is one of the most unsavory episodes in American history, and Cotton Mather has taken the blame in history because of it in a way that's not entirely fair. One of the great scholars of American Puritanism, I think, was named Morrison. I think it was he who said that there was a critic named Califf, Robert Califf, who wrote about the whole thing and put the blame on Cotton Mather and tried to caricature him and make him look like he was responsible for the whole thing, as if he was the one calling for people's deaths, which wasn't true. But Morrison said that Califf tied a tin can to Cotton Mather that has rattled through the generations of history. And that's true. There is a good book on the subject, and I can't think of the author's name. I'll have to look it up.
I can. I know the author's name. Not many people know this. It's one of the unforgotten Mathers, Wagon Wheel Mather.
No, it wasn't a Mather.
How many people are familiar with his work?
Yeah, I'll think of it and maybe put it on my Twitter account.
All right, now, Phil, a comment and then a couple of questions on this deal. I know how, those girls that were doing weird manifesting stuff.
Yeah.
I know where that got started for them. Do you know?
Yeah, there was a... They had us.
You're supposed to say no, Phil. Oh. I almost had the joke set up and finished.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize it was a joke.
Do you know these where these women that were manifesting, do you know how that all got started for them?
I give up.
Harry Potter.
Not true, but it's close, actually.
Didn't say it was a good joke. Well, I am close. Okay, explain it then.
It is close. There was a Jamaican woman who was, I think, a slave, actually, and a cook, possibly even in the pastor's house, if I recall. Her name was Tituba. Very superstitious, and she was telling these girls stories, like scary stories and stuff about witchcraft and all of that. And it got their minds in this demonic mode that issued all these accusations and things.
So I was not far off with my Harry Potter crack.
Yeah.
All right. My question for you is this. The Salem witch trials, it did involve a local church, which was puritanical in nature. And 19 people were killed, which is tragic. It doesn't sound like a lot. It is if you're one of the 19 people and their families.
Yeah, and particularly in colonial Salem, there weren't that many people in the community. Everybody knew all of these people.
Yeah, so, Phil, how, at that time when these were happening, how many people were there in the States or at least in the continent at that time? Was this just in the town of Salem? Were there other were trials and witches being killed in other towns, or just Salem?
Yeah, it was actually Salem Village, which it was the village beyond Salem, Massachusetts. It's now called Danvers. If you went there today, it's a suburb of Boston, but things are closer now than they used to be because of mass travel and all that. But it was a smaller community just outside of Salem called Salem Village.
How many people lived in that village?
I would guess no more than 150 or 200. I don't know, actually.
All right, so it was a small... Were there any other villages or towns at that time that were participating in this? Because so often, unbelievers will bring this up as some sort of way to slander Jesus, the Bible, Christianity. Was it contained to Salem Village, or were there more instances of witch trials?
I don't think there were any other witch trials other than those that originated in Salem Village, but the hysteria sort of spread to Boston. Cotton Mather was a pastor in Boston, not Salem, so he was called into the situation because he had preached on Satan and the reality of the unseen world, and so he was sort of considered to be an expert. And when he saw the strange manifestations and heard the testimony, his first response was, yeah, this is clearly a case of witchcraft. And once it got out of hand, he began to have second thoughts about it. And it was, as I said, his father who ultimately put a stop to it.
All right. But he wasn't saying we need to burn those people. He thought it was witchcraft of some sort.
Right.
But it wasn't somehow claiming that they should be killed.
I think at first he may have consented to the idea that that witchcraft is a capital crime, and that's the appropriate penalty. He had the clout that he could have stopped it at the outset if he had been so inclined, but I don't think he had evil intentions. I just think he had a lot of superstitious beliefs.
And I think, nobody is thinking that that was a good thing. I do believe every time we take a look back in history, though, and we see something that causes us to scratch our head and wonder, what were those people thinking? In fairness, you always do need to understand history at the time, what the worldview, the predominant worldviews were, understanding of anything that went bump in the night. It's not to excuse it at all, but they did live at a different time.
Right, and that was the tail end of it, really. That was the last of the major, that was the only, as far as I know, and there may have been a couple of other minor instances of witches who were people who were condemned of witchcraft and put to death in America. But that was the last big sort of outbreak of witchcraft hysteria. But prior to that, both in England and Europe and really all over the world, the killing of witches, killing of people who had been convicted of witchcraft, was a fairly common thing for, you know, a couple of hundred years before that.
Really?
I mean, it wasn't unheard of. I don't think it happened every day, but...
But it did exist.
Yeah.
All righty. So it's a history that we don't want to apologize for or defend in any way, shape, or form.
But we don't, and we don't want to repeat it, for sure.
Well, I don't think we're in danger of that happening. I would like to think not.
Right.
You were going to say something else besides right.
No, I was just going to say, I think the trade-off is that we live in an era that is so rationalistic that you have people today who don't even believe in the concept of evil. And so evil flourishes in our community. And I have this theory about the devil's strategy is that he plays to people's superstitions.
Well, that's why, you know, for whatever it was worth, again, not to defend it, but understanding history, superstition was huge. If you were struggling to survive and you thought that this could end, you know, contribute to the end of your existence, you could probably come up with some pretty bad ideas. When you're frightened for your life.
And it isn't as if someone just went through that community killing people. There were trials and lots of testimony, and all of that stuff is available to read on the web today. There's a large website that includes all of
the
original.
That's fascinating.
It is. If you read the trials, these were long and detailed trials, and the testimony that was given is hair-raising. If you lived in an era when, you know, it was driven by that sort of superstition— You can understand why people would have been frightened.
The right conclusion wasn't to kill people. All righty, Phil, let's get back to the mailbag, shall we? Phil@wretched.org. This is a bit of a conundrum. Are you ready, sir?
Yes.
The pastor's sister is married to a woman. They attend church there. My question is that it is more than just attending church. They are not in a major serving role, but they do serve as door greeters and sanctuary hosts. Can you help me with my conundrum here? Phil, what say you?
That's bad any way you look at it. I mean, if the pastor has a sister who is, you know, married to a woman and she wants to attend church, up to that point, I'm okay with it. She needs to hear the gospel. Let her come. But you can't have her in any kind of service role. I mean, she clearly doesn't meet the qualifications for someone to serve in a public thing like that in the church. And if she's professing to be a believer and living like that, then she actually needs to be subject to discipline, excommunicated from the church. She didn't say that she's a member, but I presume if she's actually functioning as a greeter, then in effect she has membership in that church, and that's a bad thing. That's tantamount to what Paul is writing to correct in the Corinthian church in 1 Corinthians 5, where he has a guy who is living with his father's wife, it says. I don't know if that's a stepmother or what, but it was a kind of incest that was shocking even to unbelievers. And Paul rebuked them for that and in fact, exercised his apostolic authority to excommunicate that man before he even arrived in Corinth. He said he turned him over to Satan for the destruction of his flesh, meaning he put him out of the church. And that's what needs to happen.
So you'd talk to the preacher is what you'd do.
Well, you certainly would talk to the preacher. But if he is determined to let this go, I wouldn't want to have fellowship with a church where open public sin is being celebrated in that way. I'd leave the church.
All right. Maybe go to the elders after that and then maybe leave the church.
Yeah. Assuming there are elders. But I mean, if it's gone that far, I wouldn't have a whole lot of hope that any talk with anybody is going to actually fix what's wrong.
Phil@wretched.org from Daniel. Titus 1 says that the children of an elder must be believers. Our church struggles through this right now since our pastor's son has walked away from the faith. The pastor has been very diligent in training up his children and has submitted to the counsel of the other church elders through the entire matter. That's excellent. The other elders have said what he had done to mitigate the situation has been the best he can do, but some think that we need to take Titus more seriously. Would the pastor have to step down since his house is no longer in order? Phil, I can't wait to hear what you have to say about this.
Yeah, well, that's actually a debated passage, and there are two views on that. One says, as the questioner says, one view is that it means the pastor's children need to be believers. The other view says, no, the word there just simply means faithful. It says they need to be faithful and not accused of riot or unruly. In other words, they can't be scandalously involved in any sort of criminal activity or anything that would discredit the church. Here at Grace Church, we hold to the former view. That's John MacArthur's interpretation, that the pastor's children need to be believers. And if they abandon the faith, then, you know, he probably ought to step out of a place of public ministry while he ministers to his own family and tries to bring them into faith in Christ.
All right.
But I would also say that's, I think, the minority view, that the majority of people would say, no, it's faithful children. So they can't be overtly rebellious or criminally involved or whatever, but especially adult children.
Okay, so going back to the former view,
yes,
which would say they must be believers. Now, let's leave this pastor aside. We're now speaking in generalities. The pastor has done his best to train up his children. Let's say he's got, I'm picking a number, 4 kids. 3 of them are believers. 1 isn't. Pretty much raised the kid the same way. The pastor has done his best. God does the saving. How would the person who holds to that the children must be believer disqualify the pastor when it is God who does the saving?
Yeah, well, see, that's the argument that undergirds the second view, that they're supposed to be faithful children. Let me actually read that text. That is Titus chapter 1, verse 6, and here's the ESV. He has to be above reproach, the husband of one wife, and his children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination. So the ESV translates it, that his children need to be believers. I think in the King James, it just says faithful children.
It is. It's New King James is also faithful.
Yeah, and that is the argument goes, that's what the word means, so they have to be, you know, faithful to the basic. They can't be unfaithful in the sense of that it describes here, using words like not accused of riot or unruly. That's the King James, or the ESV. What was it? Something about debauchery and insubordination. Mm-hmm. So they can't be rebellious or wantonly living in sin. That's the majority view. We just take a narrower view than that here at Grace Church. And it's, I think, suited us well. Not that a man is less than faithful himself just because his kids are unbelievers. Like you said, he may have done the best job he could possibly do, and they're not coming to faith. That's not necessarily his fault. David had a rebellious son, right? And you could argue that was the consequence of David's sin, or one of the consequences of his sin. So I don't know, but there is no guarantee that your children are necessarily going to become believers. But as parents, you train them the best you can and pray that they are. And the argument for the first view is that if God has chosen and ordained you to be a pastor, he's going to see to it that you meet the qualifications, and he will draw your children to Christ. As long as you're faithful in doing what you need to do as a pastor.
Yeah, because I could hear somebody say just the opposite of what you just said, that how would God call somebody, or why would God call somebody to office only to have him disqualified because he doesn't save his children?
But you hear both arguments. And again, this is probably the third week in a row I've said this. This is not an issue I would go out and pick a fight over. I think the elders of each church need to decide how they're going to interpret and apply that text and do it with as much grace as possible. But I don't think we need to go trying to impose it. It's a text that's subject to more than one interpretation, and legitimately. So there's some ambiguity there, I think. And so I'm not going to go and confront the elders of a church who practice differently than we do and tell them, you must change your view. But I think each church needs to decide how they're going to interpret that and then stick by how they interpret it.
Sent to phil@wretched.org. How should evangelicals handle early church figures and history, given the error in Catholicism and Catholic doctrine through the ages? How, quote, orthodox can we consider the church fathers and pre-Reformation theological figures? I often see or hear people refer to the ancient creeds, the fathers, people like Aquinas, Augustine, or Augustine, etc. But to what extent does their Catholic doctrine corrupt their teachings? All right, so Phil, what do we do with the early church fathers? Sometimes they were a bit of a mixed bag.
Yeah, they are a mixed bag, and you can find statements in the church. I think this is one of the fallacies that Catholic apologists try to take advantage of. They pretend that the church fathers were 100% in agreement with Roman Catholicism and that Roman Catholicism developed out of the consensus of the church fathers, and they all taught these things. They had errors in their teaching as well. So you can find erroneous things in practically every church father. And I think if the church goes another 3,000 years, people will look back at what we taught and say, these guys were in error on this thing or that thing. I don't know. But it's also possible to read the church fathers and find support for every doctrine that is distinctive to Protestant Christianity. And the early reformers were insistent on that. In fact, Calvin starts the Institutes with a dedicatory letter in which he says, look, these are not new doctrines. I didn't invent these myself. But everything he's teaching in Calvin's Institutes, he bolsters not only with Scripture, but also with references to the Church Fathers. And his complaint about the way Catholics read the Church Fathers is, Calvin says, it's as if they're attracted only to the worst things the Church Fathers ever said. So there is a mixture of truth and error in the collective writings of the Church Fathers. There was a lot that many of them didn't understand, and other things that they understood perfectly but got overwhelmed in subsequent years. Take Augustine, for example. He fought for the primacy of divine grace, the idea that we are saved by grace through faith, that God is sovereign over the human heart, and really all of the fundamental principles that underlie what we would call Calvinism come straight from Augustine. And yet, at the same time, it never cleared in his mind that if we're saved by grace apart from works, you can't inject baptism in there as a regenerative sacrament. And he mingled his view of baptism with what he taught about grace in a way that left it a little bit too confusing. And I think one of the great values we draw from the work of the early reformers is that they were able to untangle some of these errors from the truth without utterly discrediting the church fathers, which I think would be a bad thing to do.
Well, you know, going back in history, Phil, there's a progression in knowledge inside of the church that we happen to benefit from. Those guys were dealing with it pretty early on.
No question about it. In fact, the early conflicts in the church had to do mostly with the person of Christ, the doctrine of the Trinity, and all of that. They weren't arguing, for the most part, soteriology. Now, they were in the apostolic era because that's what Paul is defending against the Galatian heresy. He's defending soteriology, justification by faith, but the debates turn to the person of Christ. How do we understand the hypostatic union and the doctrine of the Trinity? And those debates raged for 300 years or longer until, with Augustine and Pelagius, the debate turned back to soteriology. And so, yeah, there's a progression, and there's also certain things that are focused on in this era that maybe weren't in that.
Well, and even the individual themselves, their early writings versus their latter writings definitely have a different flavor to them. All right, Phil, I've got an email for you. I don't understand it at all. This is from Brendan. I was wondering, I'm just going to read it because I don't get this, Phil. All right?
Okay.
I don't understand it. I was wondering if Phil had any plans to update his Bad Theology bookmarks in the near future, or even any of his bookmarks. What's a bookmark?
Oh, that's like a remnant of the early days of the World Wide Web. The earliest web browsers let you save annotated bookmarks of websites that you visited. And so I cataloged at the time all of the important Christian resources, mostly primary documents, the writings of the church fathers, and, you know, historic creedal statements, things like that, plus important websites that deal with contemporary today's Christian movements, good, bad, and not so good. And so I cataloged them. So I remember when I went back to, it was really for my own benefit, when I went back to a website, was this a bad one, a good one, or a really good one? And so I had like three categories like that. And it ultimately evolved into about seven categories where I've got really helpful resources, good apologetic resources, bad theology, really bad theology. And then some of them were so bad, I started a category called really, really bad theology. And I annotated them with, you know, kind of snarky comments explaining why, mainly for my benefit, to remember why I thought this was bad. But you could put your bookmarks on the web, and they became a web page that anybody could look at. And so my bookmarks became a source that a lot of people would go to see, is this good or bad, and why is it bad? And I tried to answer those questions. And I kept up with that, I guess, up through around 1997. And then I pretty much stopped updating it because there was so much stuff on the web, I just couldn't keep up with it. So to answer his question, no, I'm not likely to make any kind of major revision or update to that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I didn't understand any of that. Last email, Phil.
Sorry.
Are you ready? Now, please remember, you're the one who said, let's do emails.
Yes, but before we get to the next one, let me just say, you really ought to Google Phil Johnson's bookmarks and then look for the really, really bad category. You'll enjoy it.
Am I going to see a picture of me?
No.
Okay. All right, then I might. All right, last one, Phil, and this one is a piece of cake. I'm sure we'll tackle this in 30 seconds or less. I recently listened to a podcast that talked about Jesus' role in submitting to the Father. Their view was that Jesus only submitted to God the Father when he came to earth in human form because that was the only time he needed to. Could you talk about this? Does the Bible say anything regarding Jesus submitting to the Father in eternity past? Thank you. From Megan.
You're right.
That's easy, Phil.
That is easy. No, the Bible doesn't say anything about the Son submitting to the Father in eternity past. And in fact, I think it's a bad idea to suggest that he did. I did do recently a sermon on this very subject, and I don't think it's even online yet, but I'm going to make sure it gets online, okay? And look for the message called...
So this is the eternal sonship debate, correct?
That's right. And so what you're going to have to do, in fact, I'll get this online ASAP. So by the time this broadcast, it should be there. Do a Google search for my name and the title, The Eternal Sonship of Christ. That's the name of the sermon.
I got to be honest with you, Phil. I didn't think we had a chance of getting that done in 30 seconds.
Phil's Philosophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Stop doing it.
Phil, have you gone mental?
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding me?